Hi, everyone. Hello, can you hear me? Is it working? Kind of. Can you hear me? Okay, good. That's my test. We're going to start really promptly because we have a lot to cover and we want to try to leave room for questions at the end. We are going to ask to wait and try to put those at the end so we don't get bogged down and are able to at least touch on the various topics we want to introduce you to. So my name is Beth Kingsley. I'm a lawyer at a small firm, and I'm here today with a couple of accountants, and we're actually playing nice together. That may be something that you're not familiar with in your usual interactions with lawyers and accountants, but I think this is actually an area of law where, or an area where it's really important that we work as a team to figure things out for you. So I'm here with Dick LaCastro and Steve Kellen of Gelman, Rosenberg, and Friedman, and all of our contact information is in a slide at the end, which we will show you, and we're going to make, the PowerPoint, I think, was not available in advance, but it will be available eventually. We'll get it to ASAE, and I think they'll get it up on the site, so you can have all the details of all the slides if you care for them. So what I want to do is start really quickly with an overview to talk about what it is we're going to talk about. So this concept of advocacy, it's a broad category, there's a lot of things that can be considered advocacy. And what's really significant within that is a couple of subdivisions. There's lobbying, which is advocacy about legislation, a kind of advocacy about legislation, and what we call political intervention or political activity under the tax code. And as you see from the little diagram here, those things actually overlap. There are things that might be both of those. And it's important to understand where those different lines are and why they're important for different kinds of organizations.
Or neither of them.
Or neither of them, right. Well, yes. So, yeah, I don't have a pointer, but you can see that there's space that is advocacy that is neither of those, and there is some that is all of the above and some that's one or the other. And in fact, the truth is, it's a little more complicated than that, and we will get into this a bit. There is lobbying as defined for charities, 501c3 organizations, and a slightly different definition of lobbying for associations, for 501c6 organizations. And as I've tried to indicate with the little Venn diagram, that definition is somewhat broader. It actually is more encompassing. What we're going to do is talk about what goes into these different bubbles, what those definitions are, and then talk about the reporting implications and the various ways you will need to track and manage information about these activities. And with that, I believe I turn it over to Dick.
I guess it's still morning. Good morning. Can you all hear me okay back there? Is this on? Okay, good. All right, what I want to do this morning, and we've got a lot of slides that have a lot of detail on them, and, you know, Beth mentioned that, you know, accountants and lawyers playing nice is not something you usually see. Well, she didn't tell you the whole story. The only reason we're playing nice is because we're also lawyers. But we try not to. Our families eventually hope that we'll move on and do something that they can be proud of, but, you know, it is what it is. I'm not sure whether they're more ashamed of the accountant or the lawyer, but it really doesn't matter, you know? So we're playing nice together, but I can't resist, because of the law side, I can't resist putting code sections in there. But they're really not designed for you to pull out your tax code. I'm sure you do that on weekends and, you know, when you have some free time. But really just to give you a sense of, first of all, that there's, Beth pointed out, there's three different definitions. And just to give you some information to reinforce where the definitions come from. So we've got a definition for basically 501c, 4, 5, and 6, trade associations and social welfare organizations and labor unions. And then we have a definition for 501c3 charities that elect. And we'll get into that. And then we have a definition for charities that don't elect under 501H. And these will all make hopefully more sense as we go through it. But just to understand and reinforce that there's different definitions, and to go through and give you some idea of where we start. So the first thing is, when we talk about, and it applies particularly to trade associations, where it all began is, they said, well, 162E says you don't get a deduction for lobbying expenses. But, you know, being good tax planners and tax lawyers and stuff, you go, well, gee, if I can't do it, maybe I can get a deduction for paying somebody else to do it. And they said, no, no, you can't do that either. So the disallowance extends to dues you pay or other payments you make to organizations that lobby, that are allocable to lobbying expenses. And, again, we'll get into some more detail there. And basically for 162 purposes, and, again, looking at trade associations in particular, three activities: direct lobbying of It covers these three: direct lobbying of Congress and state legislatures, indirect lobbying of legislatures through grassroots and trying to influence the public in other areas that may include referenda. And the third one is a direct communication with the top federal executive branch officials on any official matter. And I think Beth's going to get into who those covered officials are as we go through and drawing some distinctions between lobbying for C6 and public charity purposes as we go through this. Now, just again, high level, I just want to touch on the points here. Direct federal and state legislative lobbying includes influencing legislation through communication with a member or an employee of federal, state legislature, or with a government official or an employee who may participate in the formulation of legislation. Legislation, because of course there's the general definition, then we got to define all the terms. Legislation includes actions with respect to acts, bills, resolutions, and similar things. Or by trying to influence the public in a referendum initiative, constitutional amendment. Now, action, they limit, and you'll see some of these are very, for all three definitions, some of these are very similar. Actions limited to introduction, amendment, repeal, enactment, defeat of legislative type. So now we've got an action on a bill, and you say, okay, well, what else does what does it mean to influence legislation? And it says, really, this is where we get to the definition of, as we drill down, we get to the definition of a lobbying communication. And not only the lobbying communication itself, but also things that surround the lobbying communication, like research, preparation, planning, and coordination. So it's not just the communication itself. So attempting to influence legislation through a lobbying communication is really what we're talking about. And it includes, obviously, communication with a member or employee of a legislative body, similar to what we talked about before. You got to be communicating. The thing you want to take away from this is it's got to be communicating with the right person, or if you're trying not to lobby, with the wrong person. If you're trying to reduce your lobbying expenditures, so you got to have a lobbying communication. In order to fit that, it's got to be with the right person. It must refer to specific legislation and reflect a view on it. So, and we'll reinforce those elements before, because there's so much definitional stuff in these regs and trying to figure out what's lobbying for C3, C6 purposes that you can get lost, you can lose the forest for the trees here. So remember, a lobbying communication, it's got to refer to specific legislation for these purposes and reflect a view on it, or clarify or amplify or, update or modify a prior lobbying communication. Just so you know, specific legislation, because you always say, well, what is specific legislation? Does it have to be proposed? It includes things that aren't yet introduced into a legislative body. And we'll talk about this, I think, a little bit later, too, but does not, refer to something that's compelled by subpoena or required by law. And legislative bodies don't include executive, judicial, or other administrative bodies or local councils. So that's a little bit kind of the highlights of what a lobbying communication is for 162 purposes that applies to the non-deductibility of dues, basically, to your trade associations and C4s and C5s. Now, grassroots lobbying is a little bit different. So when you have a direct lobbying communication, you're going directly to the person that has the ability to affect the legislation. It's a little, obviously, it's more detailed than that. We've got some specifics on who those people are. But with grassroots, it's a little bit broader in the sense that you're influencing the general public on legislative matters or referendums. So instead of going directly to the legislature or the other appropriate covered executive officials, you're going to the public and trying to get them to act. So that's really the difference between direct and grassroots lobbying. A couple things to note. In this case, it applies to not only federal, state, but local level. You can have a lobbying communication. And it's not really clear, but legislative matters or referendums is not defined, but they didn't use the same language as they did. So legislative matters may be broader than legislation, but there's not really a whole lot of detail on that. So we're talking about lobbying communications. One thing we need to look at, particularly with trade associations, is, you know, what is our communications with members? Does that constitute, what if we get our members to act? Or, you know, have communication with members that may affect that. And again, we'll, in drawing some of the distinctions a little bit later, we'll draw some of that out. But just so you know, you can have communications with members that are considered grassroots lobbying, if it attempts to develop an opinion about pending legislation. But as with other grassroots lobbying, there really needs to be, you probably have to have a call to action there to have it considered to be grassroots. I'm not going to touch on this too much because Beth's going to get into this. But remember, not only is it just actions of legislators for 162 purposes, but it also includes certain covered officials in the executive branch. Now, from our perspective, you know, and Steve and I deal a lot with, you know, advising organizations, reviewing 990s, helping them, you know, deal with the compliance issues. You know, one of the things that you really need to focus on when you say, okay, we've got lobbying activities, you know, how do we capture those costs? And I know some organizations are very sophisticated. They have timesheets. They really spend a lot of time, not only for 990 purposes, which is probably the least of their worries, but more for, and again, Beth will get into Lobbying Disclosure Act and making sure that we're capturing and identifying and knowing when we need to file. And there is some overlap there. But we basically got three methods. And there's a ratio method, a gross-up method, and a 263A, 263 cap A, to capture those costs. And just so you know, just to emphasize, lobbying costs include labor, general, and administrative. It's not just, you know, the direct cost, but it would also extend to costs that are considered overhead. And I want to spend a little bit of time just drawing out those the three, a little bit more about those three methods and how they differ a little bit. And as I mentioned, the gross-up method, there's actually two gross-up methods that I'll mention. Ratio method is a cost that are allocated based on the ratio of your total, it should say lobbying labor hours, versus your total labor hours. And you take that ratio, basically it's saying, how much time do I spend lobbying versus doing everything else? And times the total cost of your operations. A couple of points on that. The total cost of operations don't include third-party costs, which are basically what you pay outsiders. You hire a lobbying firm to do some work. And it excludes the third-party labor costs, the amounts that you pay outside. So that wouldn't be included in your cost of operations. And in your total labor hours, you can exclude some hours of clerical or support staff that don't really have any connection with the lobbying. So that's the ratio method. The gross-up method is basically you take 175% of your basic lobbying costs, and it's your cost of wages or other similar costs that you incur, but doesn't include, you know, the fringe benefit type things like pension, profit sharing, benefits, or other similar costs. So you find out what your direct labor costs are there, and you multiply it by 175%. That does include, again, in distinguish the 175 gross, the original gross-up method, it does include costs of clerical or other support that are involved in the lobbying. The alternative method is instead of 175%, you can use 225%, but you get to exclude some of those administrative type costs. And I guess, I don't know if I should admit to this, Steve, but, you know, when we get information to do the 990s, we assume that you all are saying, yeah, we're capturing these things properly. Beth's laughing because we said that on the phone when we were coordinating this, and she said, you guys do know that's a big assumption, right? And so I said, well, you know, that's why we're here, you know, is to have these discussions and make sure that people understand that, you know, there's different ways to capture it. And hopefully you're including all the things you need to.
We seem to have adopted the don't ask, don't tell philosophy.
So, the third option, and I have never seen this, 263 cap A. I remember this came out, this is a way to allocate cost to inventory. And this came out when I first started in accounting, and I still don't understand it. And I don't know anybody that uses it. It's a very complex step allocation methodology to be very precise. And I think the only reason you might use that is if you thought that the other methods just generated way too high a number than you were comfortable with and you wanted to get really specific about what it is. But you may spend more time on that trying to do that calculation than you would on trying to figure out what lobbying is. So my advice, stay away from that if anybody ever suggests that. So that's the definition that basically applies to C3, C4, C5s under 162. Now, the second definition is for 501c3 organizations. And, you know, this is the first of two. They can either be electing or non-electing under 501H. And if you don't elect under 501H, which is an expenditure test, you're left with this kind of general, vague, non-specific type of thing that says, you know what? You can't qualify as a C3 organization if you're, the term they use in the regs is an action organization. And an action organization is basically one where a substantial part of your activities are attempting to influence legislation. They use the term, I think, in the regs, propaganda, which, you know, sounds kind of bad. So they sit there and say, you can't be a C3 if you do more than where a substantial part of your activities is lobbying. So you say, okay, so we call it, you know, basically the substantial part test. Just a note there, lobbying in this case doesn't include nonpartisan analysis or research and making things available to the general public, but basically it says you can't qualify as a C3 if you're doing too much lobbying. And they have a definition, and I'll just, you know, it's very similar in ways to the definition that we talked about before. You're either contacting legislatures or the general public in support or opposition of legislation, or you're advocating the adoption or repeal or rejection of legislation. Legislation, actions by Congress, state legislature, or local council or similarly governing bodies, which is different than what we just saw, or action by the public. So we say, okay, well, you know, what you really need to know about the 501c3 if you're a non-electing organization is that what constitutes lobbying can be vague. Really vague. And how much is substantial is unclear. So with the, if you, and we'll talk about the pros and cons of electing, but if you're under the non-electing standard or 501c3, you say, well, 5% substantial? 10%? 15? There's some cases out there that talk about it, but, there's really no hard and fast guideline. So you could be sitting there saying, well, we think we're okay, but we're not really sure. The measure of substantiality, when we talk about the 501H test for lobbying, is an expenditure test. So it's very clear cut. What are your expenditures? Are they within the right parameters? With the substantiality test here, we're talking about, well, geez, it's not just what I spend, but what are my activities? And that can include things like volunteer hours and other resources devoted to it. And the other thing to worry about here under, if you're under the 501c3 test is there's no real statutory exceptions. There may be some definitional things in cases and regs that say, well, this activity doesn't really constitute lobbying, but you don't really have specific exceptions to it.
And when we were talking to Beth last week and going through the slides, Dick was bringing up the point about not knowing what the definition was or what the limit was, and Beth brought up, I thought, an interesting perspective. If you're a non-electing, a 501H non-electing organization, and you need to know what the definition is, you probably need to make the election. If the definition is important to you, you probably need to make the election.
So that's the, see, I have to make sure I keep on time because, you know, if you present by yourself and you run over, the only people that get mad are you guys. If you're presenting, Steve and I present a lot together, and if I go over, then he gets mad at me. But now I've got two other people to worry about. So the third definition we have is if we elect under 501H. And the first thing you need to understand is it's an alternative to the substantial part test, and it's an expenditure test. So it's based on expenditure. What Congress wanted was something that was very clear. Everybody complained that, well, we don't know how much is too much. And you see this a little bit with some of the things that are happening in the political things with C4s and super PACs, and everybody's saying, well, how much is too much lobbying or political activity? And so they said, well, let's just make it clear cut, and you can elect in or elect out, and there you go. And I think for the most part it's been well received. It's been around for a while now. You have to be an organization that's eligible to deduct. A 501c3 that's an A1, an A2, an A3, which is a supporting organization, or, you know, public charity, basically an A1 or A2, or colleges and hospitals, organizations like that. And basically what it says is, we're going to tell you how much lobbying is okay based on your expenditures, and if you go over it, we're going to tax you. And if you do it for a long time and go over certain limits, your exemption could be at risk. So, and again, I think Steve's going to go through some examples on that. So basically what it says is, how much your expenditures are, it's a sliding scale. If you're a smaller organization, your threshold for allowable lobbying is going to be less. If you're a large organization, up to, I believe it's $17 million in expenditures, you're going to have more. So depending on the amount of your expenditures for what it calls exempt purpose expenditures, determines what your limit is. And there's two things. The maximum is going to be allowed is for expenditures $17 million and over is $1 million. But you need to know that there's a specific limit on grassroots. So if you have $1 million limit, if you're a large organization, you have $1 million limit for overall lobbying, you're going to be limited to 25% of that amount for grassroots. So your grassroots can't go over 250, even if you're under that $1 million cap. And as I mentioned, if your non-taxable amount over a four-year period is exceeded, because they give you a limit that says this is your non-taxable lobbying amount, if you exceed that by 150%, you would lose your exempt status.
Right, 1 minute, Dick.
Okay,
I'm turning off this mic in one minute.
I didn't get a 2 minute warning, so.
Yeah.
And just going through some of the definitions of lobbying, I'll hit the highlights for 4911 purposes. So we've got a definition under 162, we've got a definition under 501c3 regs, and then we got another definition over 4911. And again, they're very similar, but attempting to influence legislation either indirectly, the opinion of the general public, that's grassroots, or communication with a member of a legislative body or a government official who may participate in this. And Beth has a slide in here later that's going to distinguish this definition from the other ones. Legislation is action by Congress or, you know, by the public in a referendum, and introduction, amendment, enactment of bills. So very similar to what we've seen before. Now, when you identify the cost, the expenditure includes all the costs of preparing direct or indirect lobbying communications, including deferred compensation, administrative overhead, those kind of things, and other general expenses. And the cost of research, drafting, reviewing, publishing and mailing the communication are included as well. So it's not just, okay, I spent an hour on the Hill doing this, or I mailed this newsletter out and this is what it costs. It's all those other related costs that would go in there as well. So when we think about lobbying, just to kind of pull back a little bit and say, when you get lost in the morass of the regs and all that, say, what is lobbying? Well, we need a communication. For direct, we need a communication to the right person, expressing a view on specific legislation, and it's to the legislator or whoever the right person is on that. You need to have all those elements to have a direct lobbying communication. For grassroots, it's, again, communication, expressing a view on specific legislation to the general public, and not just to the general public, but there has to be a call to action. And a call to action can be, urging them to contact their legislator, or, here's a pre-printed postcard, sign it, send it into your legislator. It has to be a call to action.
I think it's important to emphasize that there's specifically defined kinds of calls to action. And if you don't have one of them, if you're talking to the public, you're not doing lobbying. So that is part of the space that is advocacy that is not lobbying. We took the slide out, but there's a special rule on members. So if you're talking to your bona fide members, people who've made more than a nominal commitment of time or money to the organization, such as paying dues, they are not the public. And if you discuss legislation and have a call to action, that's considered direct lobbying. There's actually, we could do like an hour and a half, 2 hours just on the lobbying definitions alone. So I apologize for not being able to go into all the nitty gritty, but yeah, that's the basic.
Now, my question is, this 501
election
for 501 organizations?
Only for
C3s. Only C3s.
Right.
And not all C3s, but most C3s.
That's
correct. So you would be under the first definition that we talked about under 162E, because that applies to C4s, 5s, and 6s, basically. A couple things about some statutory exceptions. I mentioned that under the C3 test, the kind of the vague one, there's no specific exceptions. But we have some specific exceptions here. And I'm going to talk about the first one, and then Beth is going to talk about the rest of them. Examination and discussion of broad social and economic or similar problems. So if it's a broad communication, that let's say you're participating in a roundtable about global warming, and you have someone from your organization that participates, that's fine. You have to be careful if there's specific legislation that's proposed or they're talking about, you can't refer to that directly, and you can't really have a call to action, or you could cross over and fall out of this exception.
Okay, and the other exceptions, the next most useful one, I like to call it invited testimony. You'll sometimes hear it called technical advice, which I don't like because I think that's misleading. This is an exception that requires that you be responding to a written request from a legislative body or committee or subcommittee to provide either oral or written testimony. And it only applies to direct lobbying. This does not apply to any sort of grassroots campaign. The written invitation is really critical, though. Get that, keep it in your files if you want to rely on this exception. Animation problems. Self-defense, this is a fairly limited exception, but it can be important. A response to legislation or proposed legislation that would affect the organization's existence, powers, and duties, its tax-exempt status, or its ability to accept deductible contributions, that's not lobbying, even though it otherwise would be. But again, it only is for direct communications with the legislature. It doesn't allow you to do grassroots lobbying on those issues. And also, let me just point out that the fact that a budget cut is going to affect your ability to get grant funds from the government, even if that might threaten the organization's existence, that's not covered here. It's really about, say, it would be illegal for you to conduct the business you conduct. Finally, nonpartisan study, analysis, and research. This is, the exception, the premise is that we want the legislature to be able to be fully informed and draw on the expertise of the nonprofit community as they make policy decisions. So if you're not merely advocating, you're not just saying do what we want, but you have reasoned analysis that contributes to the debate, we want to create an exception for that. It does need to argue from facts and be a sufficiently full and fair discussion that an independent reader could come to their own conclusion. You can have a point of view, but someone needs to be able to disagree with you. You can't just advocate your own point of view without having a basis for it. And it does need to be made publicly available or available to an entire legislative body. Again, because the idea is you're informing the process, not just giving it to your friends as ammunition or giving it to the target, the people who don't agree with you, in order to persuade them. So that is the quick summary of things which are not lobbying for C3s.
So how much lobbying can you do? So you're with a C5. What's your lobbying limit? Unlimited. Good answer. So, whoops, I'm going the wrong way here. So how much is too much lobbying? So I talk about C6s, but it would be 4 5s or 6. There is no limit. As long as you're lobbying on something that's related to your exempt purpose, there is no limit. So how much can you do if what are the consequences of a non-electing, a non-501H electing C3, it's loss of exemption, and you're back to no substantial part. And Dick, how much is no substantial part? Yeah, what's lobbying? Yeah. So I think there was a case many years ago that said 5% was okay. So I don't know if that means, and it doesn't use the word majority, so I think the no substantial part is probably between 5% and 50%, but there really is no authority on that.
There is one case that says between 16 and 20% was substantial.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think most people say 5% is probably safe, but it's really uncertain.
So.
The 1 million only doesn't apply under that the no substantial part test.
Right. And there's even a question about what it is you're measuring. So, if you make the election, and Dick, you'll hear some of these stuff, some of these points will be made over and over again, either by me on my own slides or complimenting what Dick and Beth are saying. But if you make the C3 election, there are annual limits and 4-year limits. And there are two tests on each. On the annual limit, and we'll go through them in more detail later, but on the annual limit, if you violate one of the two annual limits, there's an excise tax paid that year. If you violate either of the two four-year limits, you lose your exemption. All right, so this was, we weren't quite sure where I put this slide here, but I thought 501H was an interesting story. It arose because there was no definition of lobbying and no definition of how much you could do, and taxpayers were complaining. So Congress, in 1976, created 501H. And I remember I was new to the world of tax accounting back then, but I remember all the exempt organizations said, God, if we elect this, it's going to be on a hit list. The IRS is going to come audit us. And the IRS said, we're just implementing. This is a congressional initiative in response to taxpayers who wanted something. There's no hit list. We're not coming after you. And I think in hindsight, 35 years later, that is true. That we're not seeing evidence that electing or not electing necessarily makes you more or less likely to be audited. I would say in our world of 501c3s, which is probably 400 or 500 clients, it probably runs 50-50. And the ones that are not electing are typically have little to no lobbying. It's not really relevant to them. So the pros and cons. What are the pros of making the election? You have higher limits. Maybe, but generally speaking, it might be a higher limit compared to the 5%. There are clear definitions. There's an objective calculation. Volunteer efforts are not included. And if you have a lot of lobbying in 1 year, you have an excise tax, but your exemption is not at risk. The cons, who shouldn't elect? Dick and I both in a prior life were with a big firm that had big clients, including Red Cross and National Geographic. When your budget is $1 billion, the $1 million doesn't look so large anymore. So if you're mega size and you want to do lobbying because it's important to you, then maybe the 501H election is more binding than any calculation under, less than 5%. And I've had some clients that have said, I'd rather not know. If I know if I make the election and do the calculation, I'm in trouble. Maybe not knowing how much I can do is a better place to be. And again, as Beth said, for most of our clients, if you need to know what the non-electing rules are, you probably need to be making the election. All right, I think in the history of the U.S. government, this may be the most simple form ever devised by the IRS. And this is a little bit inaccurate because it takes a whole screen. And in the real form, it's only the top third of the page. The bottom two-thirds are the instructions. And it's just, name and address. It's one election, two revocation. It's the simplest form ever devised. Under number one, under election, it says it is effective if made within the first taxable year. So you can make it in the year, and it's applicable to that year. On the revocation, it says before the first day to which it applies. So you have to get it done in December, if you want it to be effective in January, assuming you're a calendar year taxpayer. But incredibly simple to get in or out. The hard part is we asked clients, did you make the election? They said, yeah. I said, well, do you have the election? That was, 30 years ago. No one knows where this half piece of paper is. But presumably, if you had enough interest, you could call the IRS and they will confirm that. All right. So this is back now to Beth. All right. Grab the rest of my slides.
Right. So to finish up our discussion of lobbying definitions, we've spent a lot of time with the tax code. There are other laws that you may need to be aware of. And actually, what I'm talking about here is the Federal Lobbying Disclosure Act. Most states have similar laws, but every state is different. So if you're doing advocacy on legislation or any governmental action at the state level, you need to check on what the rules are there. Yeah. It's complicated. So the Lobbying Disclosure Act, on its and bear with me because at the end of this I will tell you that it's not as bad as it seems in terms of complexity. It has its own definitions which are not the same. Oh, actually, but there is a saving grace, which is that either a C4, C5, or C6, which is covered by the 162 proxy tax rules, so you track and report your lobbying under those definitions, or a public charity, a C3 that's covered by 501H that tracks and reports using those definitions, rather than having to rely on the different definitions under LDA and basically keep two sets of books, one for reporting to the federal government under LDA and one for reporting to the federal government on your tax form, you can mostly rely on the numbers that you're tracking for lobbying for tax purposes and use those for Lobby Disclosure Act purposes. And so this is a comparison to sort of summarize how some of these things work. If you're not covered by one of those tax provisions and you're only worrying about Lobby Disclosure Act, the purpose of it is in the name. It's a disclosure statute. This is not a substantive limit. It's about transparency and letting the public know who's spending money to influence governmental action. It's a federal statute. It only cares about attempts to influence the federal government. Doesn't include grassroots advocacy, but it does include the executive branch. And as with each of these, there are slightly different exceptions that are applicable. In contrast, 501c3, this is actually about qualification for charitable status, and it's about lobbying as an activity. So federal, state, local, and indeed international would be covered. It does include grassroots, as Dick just described. It does not include non-legislative actions and has its own set of exceptions. And under 162E, that includes federal and state, but not local. It does include grassroots. It includes executive branch actions by specific officials, and it is fairly broadly defined. To look at the executive branch distinctions, because we haven't talked about those, under LDA, it's very senior people who the contacts. I mean, in other words, not every communication with someone at an executive agency is considered lobbying for LDA purposes. But president, vice president, employees in the executive office of the president, it's basically the senior executive service, uniformed services at grade 7 and above, and Schedule C, that's plum book appointees. So those senior folks are covered under LDA. A slightly different list for 162 purposes, and you can see why it's a good thing that you don't actually have to track both of these, at least in terms of having all of your staff keep time and records. You figure out which one applies, you implement that one. And I guess a final sort of note before we move from lobbying to political activity, that you may be doing things that you consider to be lobbying, that really are, for tax purposes, considered lobbying. But there may be reporting obligations under the Federal Election Campaign Act or possibly under state law where certain communications, which if they refer to a candidate and are broadcast, TV, radio, satellite, cable, within a certain window before an election, and if they are, they use the word targeted, but really it's if it's accessible to a certain number of people in the relevant district, that is considered an electioneering communication and requires reporting, and in fact, under a recent court decision, may require disclosure of many of your donors or members. So this is an area, before you go on the air, identifying federal candidates, and again, even if it is a lobbying communication where you say, you know, Senator Jones is on the committee that's hearing this, they're considering this bill, let Senator Jones know you want him to vote yes. So I haven't said anything critical or anything about Senator Jones other than please lobby him. That's identifying a candidate and could trigger this. So something to be aware of. That said, we want to talk, we mentioned advocacy, we've got the lobbying piece, and now we also want to talk about the political piece, the electoral advocacy, and the different definitions that may apply there. This is a rather busy chart, but I think you get the idea that we have over on the left side that which is C3 permissible. It is not allowed to intervene in an election on behalf of or in opposition to a candidate for office, any office, dog catcher up to president, and again, also foreign elections. And there is a line, which you can see it's sort of defined by campaign intervention, so the C3 activity comes right up to the point at the beginning where campaign intervention starts. That's a tax definition. 501c6s, as well as C4s and C5s, they can go across that line, and their activity can actually be campaign intervention. It can also even cross the next line, which we call express advocacy, saying vote for, vote against. That's as a result of the Citizens United decision, which I'm sure you've all heard about. But to maintain their tax status, they have to primarily be doing things that aren't political, electoral. And when I say political, I really mean electoral about candidates. I don't mean it in the broader sense of influencing public policy. And then we have super PACs and contribution PACs, which do even more explicitly and more direct support of candidates. But those are sort of where the tax lines are drawn. And the question we need to look at is where does that campaign intervention piece begin? If I'm saying vote for so-and-so, vote against so-and-so, we know that's political. There's no question there. It's the other stuff that isn't quite that clear. I like this little animation. We have two sides of the same coin. That which is campaign intervention for a 501c3 is also, for tax purposes, considered exempt function under Section 527. There are a few exceptions because, for instance, 527 covers offices in a political party. But basically, if we're looking at communications about candidates for office, it's the same test. And that test is a facts and circumstances analysis. You can see this fades in because it's, I think, a rather fuzzy and ambiguous test. The entirety of it is based on all the analysis of all the facts and circumstances. Did the organization intervene in a political campaign? And again, this is the same, we know that it's fundamentally the same standard that a C3 has to use to know if it has stepped over the line into what it's not allowed to do at all and what a C4, C5, C6 needs to do because it has to track political activity under 162, because it is also non-deductible. Again, minor exceptions in scope, but the same type of test. If you're interested in the details on this, there's actually a couple very useful revenue rulings, 2004-6 and 2007-41. You can get to them by typing those numbers into a search box, basically. And they have, in addition to sort of setting out some of the legal standards, they have a lot of examples, which I find very helpful when it's a facts and circumstances analysis. Seeing how a set of facts plays out can be really useful.
I think you made those rulings available to ASAE.
Oh, I believe I did.
And I think they've made it available either, I don't know, it may not be in handout materials, but on the conference website.
Yeah. So those are real, and 2004-6 is the one that applies to C4, 5, 6s, and 2007-41 applies to C3s, and you can see that they overlap to a tremendous extent. So what are these facts and circumstances? Well, I can't give you a bright line, but I can tell you, obviously, if you expressly support or oppose or endorse a candidate, making contributions, these are actually, I can give you a bright line on those. Rating or scoring candidates on issues. So a legislative report card that gives letter grades. Even if you cover everyone in the legislature, the IRS looks on that as campaign intervention because you're giving a bottom line assessment of someone's performance in office. Comparing your position to that of a candidate is not necessarily fatal, but it is a sort of hallmark of campaign intervention. I can compare my position to that of a candidate if I'm trying to influence an upcoming legislative vote. Because it's relevant to say, you know, Senator Smith has not supported this, and you need to let him know you want him to change his position and support it. But if I'm simply saying he says X and we say not X, there's an implicit suggestion that I don't support that candidate. You also need to think a little bit about other assistance, such as mailing list rentals, that's a big one. A 501c3 should not rent its mailing list to one candidate, even if it gets fair market value, if it doesn't make it equally available to all candidates in the race, because that access is something valuable. Things that are not electioneering, within limits, a lot of nonpartisan citizen engagement, registering voters, doing voter education, continuing your advocacy about issues or your lobbying that you do otherwise, continuing that into an election year, engaging with the candidates. A lot of these things can be done within a nonpartisan context, within the careful to observe the rules, but those are not necessarily going to be a problem. So again, another way to think about this, some good facts, if we don't have a reference to candidates or elections, and this is really if we're looking at a communication. So I'm arguing this is lobbying, it's not electioneering, well, what am I going to ask? I'm going to look at, is there an external factor, like an upcoming vote? Do I discuss a broad range of issues or a narrow wedge divisive issue? Is it an issue I've worked on in the past, or have I just suddenly found an interest in this in October of an even year? Bad facts are, if you do refer to a candidate, timing driven by an election is a problem, politically motivated targeting, and again, comparing your position to that of the candidate. None of these are necessarily, well, politically motivated targeting is pretty bad, but none of those are inherently determinative, but if you sort of add up all the facts and circumstances and come out with a lot more bad facts than good facts, you're probably looking at something that is electioneering. And I actually think in the interest of time, I want to go ahead a couple slides because I have an example, and I would recommend to you the exercise of going through those factors and applying them to an example. And it's in the PowerPoint, which we'll give you access to, but it's kind of fun to work it through. Okay. Sorry, I can't figure out what number I want to go to, so we're just gonna...
Going the wrong way.
I'm going the wrong way. Why am I going the wrong way? Sorry, why am I going the wrong way?
So if you just use the down button, it'll get...
Okay.
We gotta get out of the...
Here. Okay, sorry. Technology issues. So the bottom line is, whatever this thing is, this fact and circumstances defined activity, a C3 can't do even the tiniest amount of it without jeopardizing its exemption. It has to be not the primary activity of a C4, 5, or 6. And it is what a 527 organization does, if that is a type of entity you are concerned about. I believe we're going to move on to reporting.
So for many years, I always thought it was my failing that I never could understand exactly where these rules started and stopped. And it was, it was when I moved firms, and it turned out that Harmon Curran and Gelman Rosenberg share a lot of clients. And I met Beth, and she's now convinced me that it may be a limitation of mine, but in this case, it's with good reason that the lines are fuzzy, and have been that way forever. So if you're saying, I don't understand what she said, that's part of the problem, is there are very few bright lines. Okay, so now we're going to talk about reporting. We've tried to give you an overview on what is lobbying and what you do with it. So now we're going to say, what do you do with it on your tax return? So I was going to start with 501c3s, and this is the statutory C3, the non-H-electing C3. So in my example, maybe I just got to move. Doesn't look like the whole. Can we get this more? The edge of the right side is more visible. But anyway, so in this example, there's $200,000 of lobbying, and if you didn't make the election, you use this part of the 990 Schedule C form. It's Part 2B, and you check the boxes of which types of activities you have. I don't know if it's just simple of tilting. Now, because we're still missing the thing. Okay, so, but this says $200,000 in the bottom, and you have to distribute what you do and how much you spent the money, and, that's how you go about it on the non-electing statutory C3. So, we talked about earlier, if you made the 501H election, now you use Part 2A, and I mentioned earlier there were four tests. Two are an annual test, and two are a four-year test. So let me see if I can walk you through this. On the top is the current year test. So the first line is total lobbying expenditures for grassroots. So you have to identify grassroots, and that goes on 1A. And then 1B is direct lobbying. And then 1C is just the total of the two. So we have the same $200,000, but now we've divided it up and reported it rather than by activities into now we're doing it by grassroots and direct definitions. Other exempt purpose expenditures. So we know we have another $1.5 million that were spent on allowable exempt organ expenditures. So our total exempt purpose expenditures are $1.7 million. $1.5 million of doing our business that is not lobbying and $200,000 that is. So you take your $1.7 million and you go to this chart on the left, and it's like graduated income tax rates, except they go down. It starts at 20% and it works its way down. The larger you get, the larger you are, the smaller incremental piece you get. And as was mentioned earlier, over $17 million, it's a $1 million cap. So when you go through this on $1.7 million, you end up with $235,000 of overall lobbying limitation. And if you go down to 1G in the, below the chart, grassroots lobbying, it's always 25% of the amount that's on 1F. So the 235 becomes 58,750 for the grassroots piece. And then you got to go back on lines H and I to see whether you've had an excess expenditure. So is your overall limitation of 235 been exceeded by your total expenditures of 200? No. Is your grassroots limitation 58 exceeded by the amount on line 1A? No, because it's only 20,000. But if either of those would have been exceeded, you'd have an amount on H or I, and you have to file form 4720 to pay the excise tax. On the bottom of the form is the four-year test. So they take 4 years of your overall lobbying limit, and I just made up numbers here, it comes to 985. And they said, loss of exemption is so significant that we need to protect people that don't stumble on it. So they give you effectively a 50% cushion. They take the 985 and it says lobbying ceiling amount 150%. Figure out what your limit was for each of the 4 years, add them up, take 150%, and that's your 4 year limit, $1.4 million. And then the grassroots piece limit is 1/4 of that. It's the same calculation just on a 4 year basis. And if your 4 year actual lobbying, 755, exceeds your 4 year limit, 1,477, you lose your exemption. If your grassroots piece, 140, exceeds your grassroots limits, 369, you lose your exemption. So, simple to do, but you have to understand the perspective in it. Alright, so let me go back and talk about, other exempt purpose expenditures up above. What qualifies in as an expense before you get to the chart? So, expense purpose expenditures include charitable purposes. Exempt purposes isn't where I'm supposed to be here. Yeah, deferred compensation, allocable overhead, lobbying, including lobbying rules exclusion. So you have to go through this and figure out what is included in there. More importantly, I think, is what's not included in here. And what's not included in here is a separate fundraising unit. If you have a separate fundraising unit, it doesn't count in going through the chart to determine your limit. What's a separate fundraising unit? Two or more persons spending a majority of time in the area. So the practical question is, and we do a ton of 990s, and lots of our clients are unsophisticated, and we said, well, do you have a separate fundraising unit? I think there are, maybe three alternatives. One alternative is you do the calculation, figure out what your separate fundraising unit is, and exclude it. And frankly, we don't do that a lot. The other alternative is just we know what the fundraising department is in total on the financial statements, and we just back that out. And the third is, we ignore it. And we do that in some of our clients. And typically, it's a shortcut I'm not proud of, but it's a practical answer for clients who can't put their hands around it. We're very sensitive to not using that in cases where they're anywhere near the limit. So if we left in $20,000 of expenses in a calculation where it really didn't matter, so maybe the answer is so what. Beth would never say so what, but right. Okay, so now that was C3s. Now we're talking about C6s. So C6s are going to do lobbying. Are there any? Raise your hand if you're not affiliated with a C6. So a couple. Okay, so most of you are C6, and you probably know if you're doing lobbying, you have a choice. You can either tax at the highest rates, or you can provide a notice to your member. Let me get back to what I do with my other here. Okay. All right. So. Do any of you here not do lobbying but do not provide a notice? Got one sheepishly raising her hand and a guy here, and so I've had one client in my life that just said it's just easier to pay the tax. All of our members are, you know, we have a limited number of members. They're all successful. They're all at the highest marginal rate. We'll just pay the tax. And I said, well, you're going to have to ask them for more money to replace the dues you're spending on the tax. And they said, they don't care. They said, our mission to lobby is so imperative to them that whatever we asked them for, they would just send the money. But generally speaking, that's really the exception. So the benefits of the notice over paying the tax is there's no follow-up with members. So you tell them 10% of your dues is not deductible. You don't have to go audit them to make sure that they got to the tax director there and they didn't do it. You have to tell them, but you're not the IRS's policeman on whether they're doing it right. You don't have to ask members for more dues. And the tax consequences are, it's likely at a lower rate because you're going to have some members that are in lost positions or lower in the graduated rate system. As I mentioned earlier, if you have all your members paying at the highest rate, then the tax is the same. It's only an issue whether you have to replace your operating funds because you spent it on the tax. Okay, so now we know we have to do. Raise your hand if you are actually sending your clients a dues notice that has a number that's a disallowed lobbying number. You do. If you do, all right. I'm assuming most of you send out. So there are exceptions. You have to, if you're not going to pay the tax, you have to notify your members. And there are some exceptions to that. One of them is substantially all, which then define as 90% of your dues are not deductible. And I have clients that have no idea what this means, what substantially non-deductible means. And I guess the best way to explain it is if your constituency is not generally entitled to a deduction. So if you're a 501c4 and a, you know, National Rifle Association, its members, you know, are paying dues, are likely not in a trader business that's going to allow them to deduct membership in NRA. We have a bunch of clients whose members are governmental agencies. And they're not concerned about deductions. But generally speaking, every year we have some that meet that test, but generally, it's not applicable and almost never applicable with 501c6s because it's just the nature of your members are taxable and they're gonna, they may or may not get a deduction for it, but they're at least deductible. If you have in-house lobbying expenses of $2,000 or less, you don't have to tell your members anything. Or if, you know, and you have to have no prior carryover to be exempted. So then in the materials which I have available to you are some of the statutory language, that gets you there. You'll see, let me bring this with me. There is special rule for in-house expenditures. That's where the $2,000 limit is in the statute. On the next slide has, this is an interesting one. Up on top, it says, shall be treated as paid out of dues or similar amounts to the extent thereof. So the first dollars of lobbying relate to the first dollars of dues. If you have any dues in any lobbying, you're presumed to, that they came out of dues amounts. This is an interesting one here. If you want to, you know, you're estimating in the beginning of the year. Well, it turns out your dues were higher or lower, your lobbying was higher or lower. It never turns out to be exactly right. They say, well, we understand that. And you can make it up by adjusting in the following taxable year. So if you picture a calendar year entity, and in year one, it says, we think 10% of our dues. They tell you 10%. And so let's say that's 2010. They won't know whether they're over or under till they finish 2010. So maybe it's early in 2011, maybe it's the middle part of 2011, maybe it's when you do your tax return late in 2011, but you have a deficiency. You don't want to pay the tax, so you're going to roll it forward. When can you roll it forward? It says for the following taxable year. Well, when did the dues notices for 2011 go out? Probably in 2010. Let alone in 2011. So I think most accountants that I've talked to and most lawyers I've asked said what they really mean is the next cycle of dues. The next time you send dues notices out, next time you calculate, you would include it in there. Because as a practical matter, you can't get it into the next taxable year's dues. So I said it applies to dues or similar amounts paid out of the first dollars. It has to be a reasonable estimate of what you think it's going to be. Interestingly enough, the statute says if you told your members, you know, 10% and that produced a disallowance of $100,000 and you actually spend $120,000, you can keep the $20,000. You can either pay tax on the $20,000 or you can roll it forward into the next year. But it talks about a shortage of your notices. Your expenditures were actually higher. It doesn't talk about, well, suppose I told them $100,000 disallowed and I only spend $80,000. And this has been, rule's been around for a long time. I have never seen or read anything about what happens when it flips the other way. I think that most practitioners think that Congress's objective was neutrality. They're not trying to make money on this. At the end of the day, they want the disallowance, you know, sort of globally to equal the lobbying globally. So if they penalized you for telling your members to disallow more than your actual lobbying, people would have to lowball the notices and be ever making it up. So I think it's been interpreted as the roll forward goes both for over and under expenditures. So now we're talking about how to report this on Schedule C. Here's the same $200,000, but this is a different $200,000. This is your dues assessment. You have $200,000 of dues. Your current year expenditure for lobbying is $30,000. You had a carryover for prior years. You roll it forward. So you should have told people $45,000. In fact, your dues number on the $200,000 was 20%. So you only told your members effectively $40,000. So you have a $5,000 excess. And when you get to this form, these are mutually exclusive in the software. There's an excess of five. You either can fill this in and agree to roll it forward, or the default is you come down and you have a taxable amount of $5,000 and you just pay the tax on it. All right, so this is my last and slightly confusing slide, but I said, how does this work in this three-year rule? So we have dues of $200,000 each year. We estimate, our best estimate each year, independently to that year, is we're going to spend $20,000, $30,000, and $25,000 on lobbying. So let's go down the first year. We tell them we think it's going to be $20,000 over $200,000 dues. We tell them 10%. All the dues notices say 10%. So the dues disallowed were $20,000. Actual lobbying turns out to be $30,000. So we've got an under notification of 10. We can pay the tax on that, or more likely you're going to roll it forward. So we get to year two. Now this $10,000 has to go into the carryover amount. So in addition to the $30,000 we're estimating for the current year, we have a $10,000 deficiency, $40,000. So now we're going to divide $40,000 by the $200,000. We're at 20% for this year. By telling them 20%, our dues disallowance dollar amount is $40,000. We only spent $35,000 during the year. So in theory, we've over-notified by $5,000 this year. And so now we carry it forward, and I have the question marks up there because I can't find a statutory provision that says I'm allowed to do it, but I think everybody's doing it. So, and at the end of the day, when you roll this through, sort of my proof is at the end, if you let me take a deduction for $5,000 in my estimate, at the end of the day, I've disallowed $80,000 in dues, and I've spent $80,000 in lobbying, and Congress ought to be happy. All right, so this is back to Dick.
Okay, 990 reporting, just real quickly on political activities. So we talked about lobbying. If you're a C4, 5, or 6, you know, all the lobbying and political activities are disclosed on an organization's schedule, 990 Schedule C. So there's a question on part four of the core form of the 990 that says, did you do this stuff? If you answer it yes, they say you got to fill out Schedule C. If you're a C4, 5, or 6 and you engaged in political activities, basically you need to fill out part 1A actually, and describe the activities, give the number of the total expenditures and the number of volunteer hours. Because, you know, for some organizations you can't do too much political, and you know, it's not just by expenditures, but could also be by the amount of hours that you spent. And basically, the one thing I want to caution you, for those of you that have to either provide this information or fill it out, a lot of times C4, 5s, or 6s may have an associated PAC, a separate segregated fund that they get, they collect member dues, but it's not really their dues. What they do is they say, okay, you know, $10 of this is for the separate segregated fund, and as long as you remit that timely and do the right things, it's not counted as you making a political expenditure by transferring it to the separate segregated fund. It's a little confusing on the form, but basically, in this part of it, they say, okay, how much did you expend, whether the amount that you may have paid to another organization to do political activities, or how much did you conduct yourself? It doesn't include those amounts. And then as you get a little farther down, as you'll see on line 5 of this part of the 990 or the Schedule C, it'll say list the payments to the 527s. And that includes the amount of dues that you transferred for your separate segregated fund and the other things that you you may have transferred to other PACs to, for them to do political activity. So you just have to be careful not to include that twice on the amount that you expended for your own purpose, because as long as you do the right things and transfer it timely, it's not counted as something that could potentially be taxable to you. So just because you can do political intervention doesn't mean there's not, there's potentially a tax. So the part of the 990 says, oh, by the way, did you file Form 1120 POL, which is a tax on political activities, including those of C4, 5s, and 6s. The thing you need to know here is that it's the lesser of investment income or your political expenditures. So a lot of times people that are going to do that, they say, well, if I'm going to do it directly, I need to make sure my investment income is low, otherwise I'm going to pay a tax on the higher of the two. And for a C3, which, you know, it's the IRS is telling you, oh, if you did political activities, not only could you lose your exemption, but we're going to tax you on it, and you need to tell us about it. We really don't see this much, but it would be Schedule C again, Part A, describe your political activities, and then Part 1B basically says, oh, you know, how much excise tax did you pay on the political expenditures? Did you make a correction? And did you file Form 4720 to pay the tax? And, you know, certainly it could be a red flag for the IRS to say, huh, maybe this organization, as a practical matter, any political, you know, a dollar of political intervention, you could lose your exempt status. But usually the first time or something that was not intentional and that you tried to make some correction, you'll get dinged with the tax maybe, but not lose your exemption. And the last thing is LDA reporting before we take questions.
Right. To round out reporting, the LDA reports are much, in many ways, simpler than the tax reports, much less complicated. But they are filed quarterly on the 20th day after the end of the quarter. You have to report the names of lobbyists, the issue areas, and actually you need to report who was contacted, but at this point, the law, it's at the level of the House of Representatives or the Senate. It's the very general statement of the area of government contacted. And expenditures, which is rounded to the nearest $10,000, so it's an approximate report of expenditures. But this does mean if you're relying on the 990 definitions to report under LDA, you can't wait until your fiscal year is closed to do the math. You're going to have to do it on a rolling basis to have those numbers to report here. And there's also a semi-annual form that has to be filed by both the organization and any lobbyist that it employs, anyone who meets the definition under the statute, has to do with reporting various political contributions, and even if you didn't make covered contributions, you need to make the filing because it includes a representation that you're familiar with, the House and Senate gift rules, and have not knowingly caused anyone to violate those rules. That's a fairly recent development. So that's the 10,000-foot view of LDA reporting. We have a few minutes left. We have 6 minutes left. We are cruising along here. We'd love to take questions if you have any. And actually, let me say one thing. We mentioned the 527F tax at the very end. That if you pay that tax, the investment income tax on a political expenditure, you don't also have to count that expenditure in doing your dues disallowance calculations. It's not taxed twice. So you do 527F first and then the dues disallowance.
Excellent.
Is that allocating some
Right. So that's a good. There's actually a couple points there. The question is about a separate 527 account or organization, and that can be a what's been called colloquially a 527, so it's not registered as a PAC anywhere, or it could be an actual political committee that's registered with the FEC or another campaign finance regulatory body. So you can. There are rules under campaign finance laws about how you solicit for a PAC. And you solicit your membership specifically to give to the PAC. But you can also, if you have a 527, the tax law allows you to transfer an amount of dues as long as it's a prompt and direct transfer. You can put that in the separate 527 account. Any interest that account earns may be taxed because it's doing political activity. But your main organization's treasury and investment income is protected. Do you see that often? I don't encounter it a whole lot.
We see it every once in a while because that's where you get the confusion on where to list those transfers. And when we send them information, they tend to count it twice, and we need to make sure we back it out.
Yeah, it's the you need to pay close attention to the Schedule C on how those transfers get reported because they're not. It is a transfer, but it's not in a 527 expenditure by the 501c organization. Nothing else? You have anything?
No.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your attention, and we'll be around if you have any questions you want to come up with.